Hello and welcome to Minbar. I'm your host, Ahmed Hanif. When we take a survey of the Muslim world, we realize certain things. We realize that, for example, Muslims are largely concerned about political issues, the question of Palestine, for example. We realize that Muslims are largely concerned with questions regarding Islamic law. But there are some neglected areas in Islam that in the contemporary period, Muslims do not focus on, and in fact, by and large, are ignorant about. And this has led to a vacuum in the thought of Muslims, which is being filled by ideologies or points of view that are alien to Islam. And one of these is philosophy. The Muslims have had a very long and rich history in philosophy. In fact, most Western scholars will admit that if it was not for the Muslims, the Greek heritage in philosophy would have been lost. However, today, we find very few people not only not knowing about philosophy, but also not being able to apply philosophical principles in their understanding of their own religion and their place in the world. So to discuss this issue, we are joined with Dr. Yahya Michaud from the Faculty of Theology in the University of Oxford, or Oxford University. Welcome to the show, Dr. Michaud.
Thank you for welcoming me to this show. It's a pleasure and an honor.
Why is Islamic philosophy a neglected discourse in the Muslim world?
I think we cannot generalize. And I think we have to go back to the history because things cannot just be said like this in a universal manner. For example, here in Iran, we have a tradition of philosophy, of falsafa, is still alive. It is taught in various religious and theological schools. It is not the case, for example, in Saudi Arabia. You will have excellent editions of Islamic philosophical texts in Egypt or in Tunisia or in other Turkey. So we cannot generalize, but although we have those modern developments, it is true that in the intellectual discourse of Muslims, very often today, there is no room for philosophy. Mm-hmm. So,
and why is this?
We could, but I will not follow that way. We could believe what Ernest Renan, the French intellectual in the 19th century, was saying, that falsafa, philosophy, had died with Averroes, Ibn Rushd, in 1198. Of course, for Renan, this was a very useful comment because France at the time was just invading Algeria. And to claim that Muslims were not practicing any kind of rationality anymore was opening the gate to colonization. We will teach them civilization. We will bring back rationality to their countries. So we have to be careful as well. This kind of approach, supposedly scientific, was an imperialist approach and didn't fit with the historical facts. So what are the historical facts? The historical facts are that philosophers, the falasifas, they are called in Arabic, people like El-Kindi, El-Farabi, who dies in 950, Avicenna, Ibn Sina, who dies in 1037, or Al-Ghazali later on, who dies in 1111. All those falasifa were living off the sponsorship of princes, viziers, emirs, and courts in Iran. And when this official sponsorship ended, falasifa lost their jobs.
I see.
It doesn't mean that falsafa died,
right?
But falsafa had to transform itself in order to become acceptable by the more general Muslim society. And after Al-Ghazali, you see people like Fakhreddin Razi, who dies in 1206 or 1209, I don't remember exactly, or others, who will mix philosophy and kalam, theology. Ibn Khaldun, the great Muslim historian, says that after Fakhreddin Razi, it becomes very difficult to distinguish philosophy from kalam, theology from falsafa. We have what he calls kalam mutafalsif, philosophical theology. And it is true. And that has been the reality of the historical development of philosophy for the later centuries, which explains why philosophy is still used today in theological schools in Iran. But in the Sunni world, kalam itself has often become obsolete and is only the object of some kind of intellectual archaeology. If you ask what are the treatises of Islamic theology that are available today in the Sunni world, most of them are written by non-Muslims. It is not interesting anymore for the general Muslim community. Why?
Yes, why?
Why? Because in some way this kalam in the medieval period was too scholastic. It was a very nice intellectual exercise, but it led to the most extraordinary ideas. If you look at the Mu'tazili school, for example, which was very active during the 9th century, if you look at the Mu'tazili school, they give so much importance to the human action that in some way God is losing some of his power. That's what their opponents say. And they have such an abstract idea of God himself that he becomes absent from the reality of the everyday life of the Muslims. If God is reduced to some abstract being, if he is deprived of his attributes of speech, for example, you have difficulties in explaining prophethood, and it doesn't make sense to think that you have to pray to him or to invoke him if he can hear you.
But can we say that, for example, the Mu'tazili school, for example, might reflect an extreme view,
yes,
perhaps?
It is an extreme view.
But when we look at, for example, the historical development or the appearance of philosophy, and also of theological schools of thought, schools of thought in Kalam and so on, I think we see that they come out because of the presence of competing ideas. You know, for example, there's this argument, and you should tell me what you think about it, I think. There's this argument that, for example, when Islam was expanding and it encountered different religious groups, Christians, Jews, Zoroastrians, and so forth, Islam was forced to present itself in an intellectual form, taking into consideration these doctrines and defending itself. And out of that, you'd get, for example, the whole genesis of Islamic scholasticism, philosophy, and so forth. It's expanding, it meets Greek thought, it has to address itself to that, and so forth and so on. Today, right, there's a whole lot of ideas. There are a whole lot of ideas that are sort of like antithetical to Islam, that challenge Islam. And therefore, we can say that the ground still exists for the development of an intellectual response in Islam to that.
Yes, but it is true that historically it developed very often, kalam developed very often as a reaction against objections coming from outside the Muslim world. It is true. And today we have a similar situation. The problem is that very often we do not have enough knowledge of our own tradition to be able to answer those objections that are opposed to us today. Because we are at the same time neglecting our own past and at the same time reinventing it or reducing it to a few parts instead of looking at all the possibilities offered by the great tradition, intellectual tradition of Islam in its great diversity. But if you allow me, let's go back to Mu'tazilism a minute, because I speak of this extreme, and you said that Mu'tazilism in some way represents an extreme view. It is true. Yeah. In fact, God is becoming reduced to something which will, at the end of the day, be absent from the life of people. You could say that there is a lack of divinity in Mu'tazilism in some way. On the other side, with the Ash'ari school, which reacts against Mu'tazilism, you will have an inflation of divinity. You will go from an extreme to the other, and it will be of no use today. So what have we got to do? I think that we can find in the Mu'tazili school, in the Ash'ari school, in other schools of medieval Islamic theology, we can find elements that can be very useful today. And, for example, we have, at a later period, some people who are in Sunni Islam considered sometimes as unacceptable integrist or fundamentalist, like, for example, Ibn Taymiyyah has a very bad fame for many people in some Muslim communities. In fact, we have with Ibn Taymiyyah, at the beginning of the 14th century, somebody who has read the philosophers, somebody who has seen the danger that is represented for the Muslim community by those extreme forms of theology where you have an inflation of divinity or a lack of divinity on the other side, and who tries to reconcile sound rationality independently from the Greek legacy and also what he reads in the text, the scriptural texts. And I think that that is a way that is worth revisiting, because indeed we have to, as Muslims, we have to consider that the best tools that we will have to explain the world, to deal with the world, to deal with our opponents, will come from our own scriptural sources.
Right.
And from a Sunni point of view, it will be the Quran, the tradition of the Prophet, as transmitted by those who have collected the Hadith. From the Shi'i point of view, it will be the same Quran and also the traditions that were transmitted by the family of the Prophet and the Imams. And at the end of the day, there is not much difference between the two main ways that Muslims follow. Let's re-explore those great traditions, and I'm sure that we will be able to find in those great traditions, Shi'i or Sunni, enough elements to face the world today without having to import, from non-Muslim quarters ideas that we would think would allow us or enable us to answer at the same level of intellectual
but
richness.
But wouldn't that be departing from the idea of philosophy itself? I mean, when we say, for example, when people think of philosophy, they think in terms of using reason, right? Primarily reason, and everything else being secondary. You know, even from a Muslim point of view, the Quran being secondary, but using reason to arrive at truth, to arrive at knowledge of the reality.
But if you say so, do you mean that religion, the Quran, the tradition of the Imams or of the Companions, are irrational?
No, no, no.
Are lower than rationality?
No, no, no.
Beyond rationality?
No, no, no. What I mean is this, that, for example, people could look at the sayings of the Prophet and at face value apply it, understand it, and so on. Or you could look at the sayings of the Prophet and see in it the expounding of universal principles, okay,
yep,
that philosophy tries to extract from its observance of things in the world.
Yeah.
You know, and we use these principles to be able to sometimes even evaluate whether those traditions are true or false.
Yeah.
You know, for example, the principle of contradiction. You see, you know, you apply those principles and you say, well, no, I don't accept this hadith or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, my question is it possible to have an Islamic philosophy that does not have to rely upon or use the discoveries that other philosophies have already made?
Mm-hmm. I would say that I deeply believe there is no contradiction between sound reason and authentic scriptural sources. If we depart from this position, we will in some way reduce religion to something which is beyond, infra, or irrational.
Right.
And so it doesn't mean that we will be close to things coming from outside the religion, but the opposite. It means that we will be able to reconcile what is true and which we learn from non-Muslim philosophers or even from scientists, etc., and what we read in our scriptural texts.
Mm-hmm.
There is no contradiction.
Right.
We just have to have a proper understanding of our tradition and also have a critical approach of what comes from outside
mm-hmm.
the religion. Not everything is true that we are told about
right.
by scientists or by philosophers today. There is no reason to close the door, but we also know that we will look at the world, we will look at ideas with this knowledge that we receive through the scriptural texts, and we will know that in those scriptural texts, indeed, we have a truth, and there is no contradiction
mm-hmm.
with science.
Mm-hmm.
But again, there, I think that the most important question, and which is already very well developed by Avicenna at the beginning of the 11th century, is hermeneutics. What do we do with the scriptural texts? Are those scriptural texts revealed to us, the Quran, and then the tradition of the Prophet and the traditions of the Imams, are those texts there to teach us or to guide us? And teaching is not exactly the same as guiding. A difference must be made. Very often we see today people who refer to the Quran as some kind of scientific textbook. We had a period in the 20th century, the beginning of the second part of the 20th century, where when some Muslims would say, oh, the Quran speaks of nuclear
physics and
physics.
And
it doesn't
biology
make sense.
And so on, yes.
If you write a love letter to your wife and you call her my gazelle, do you want somebody to use that letter as a textbook for zoology?
Right.
It doesn't make sense. So what is the purpose of Nubuwwat, of prophethood? What are the aims of revelation? What is the text to be used for? Is it to be read literally? Is it to be used as a textbook? Or is it to be used as a guidance. And then this guidance has got, can be understood in a far broader sense than just some food for intellects. Mm-hmm. And Avicenna, the great Iranian philosopher, in a text called Risala al-Adhawiya, fi Amr al-Ma'ad, the letter written on the occasion of the feast of Eid al-Adha, about the hereafter, attacks the Mu'tazili theologians and tell them, you're totally self-contradicting him. Because when it is about God, you have this very abstract idea of God, nothing is left of his attributes, and of course you start interpreting the text, because all those anthropomorphisms that liken God to creatures in the Quran, you say have to be interpreted, cannot be taken literally. But then when it's about the hereafter, and you hear about gardens and fires and pleasures in paradise, and reward and pains in hell, there you become completely literal. You take the Quran in its literal outward meaning. Why have you moved from metaphors to literal reading of the Quran? What is your qanun al-ta'wil?
Right.
What is the rule that you follow to understand the Quranic text?
Right.
How do you understand the final purpose of revelation? Why is it that God then would speak in metaphors about himself and would speak totally literally about the hereafter? And Avicenna attacks them. It's an extremely important text, which has been commented on later on by people like Fakhreddin al-Razi, by people like Ibn Taymiyyah and others. But the question is still there today.
Right.
What are we going to do with the text? How are we going to understand what is revealed to us? Are we going to take it as some kind of data bank of scientific facts, or even of theological facts or sociological facts, and on the other hand oppose it to what we hear from scholars, modern scholars in different sciences, or sociologists or politicians?
Right.
Is the Quran a political message? Is the Quran a textbook for anything? Those are the real questions.
Okay, hold on a minute. We have to take a quick news break. We will be right back. Stay tuned. A lot of people see the Quran as a sort of like almost a sort of a compressed source of all knowledge. That in the Quran there are principles of science, that there are principles of philosophy. There is teaching and there is guidance. That's something, it's something that needs to be opened up, which the hadith, have a very, very important role to play in opening the Quran up, in also including the aql, the intellect.
Mm-hmm. That's a particular approach.
Right.
It is an approach which is common in some schools of thought today. It is not a universal approach. Mm-hmm. And you have other schools today which consider that, in fact, the Quran speaks for itself and should not be taken as a textbook for nuclear physics. Mm-hmm. Thank God they've moved on that subject from what they were saying 50 years ago. But then, can it be taken as a textbook for other topics? Which ones? And there you see that indeed there is not only very often today an absence of those questions, there is a necessity for those questions.
Right.
Because we have all those problems today in the West. Muslims want to reintroduce Sharia. they want to introduce, they want to impose in Western societies. In Canada, for example, you had that example, Sharia Islamic law. Okay. Have you transformed Sharia into a legal system? Why don't you understand Sharia as what etymologically it means, which is a way,
right,
a way of life?
Right.
There is a difference between a way of life and a legal system.
Right.
Again, it's a question of not interpretation, just understanding the real meaning of the word.
A profundity of thought. Basically, you find that Muslims are suffering from a lack of profundity of thought, you know, which tends to lead them to some kind of literalism or sloganism, basically, in terms of their application of Islam in the world. What are the elements that has contributed to this shallowness of thinking among Muslims?
Well, I think that there are many reasons. People have spoken of the decadence of Islam during the last centuries, etc. I have my reservations towards such an approach. What is true is that after two centuries of colonization, systematic raping of Muslim countries and destruction of their culture, plundering of their wealth, and destruction of the basic structure of their society, the scar left by colonization will take ages to heal. And
do we see any healing taking place right now?
Oh, yes. It's boiling. It is boiling. You have far more debates today. You have too many debates. Everybody becomes his own mufti. Everybody becomes his own self-proclaimed, self-made imam, etc. So you have, or you have this inflation of, excuse me, of Islamic discourse today. But you have consensus developing. You have schools of thought starting to map this very informal and rich reality. So things are moving. But there are many other problems that have to be solved before Muslims find again the serenity necessary for a proper understanding of all religion. But things are taking place.
One of the problems is the gap created by the distance that Muslims have made or find themselves from the intellectual tradition. That gap is being filled now with contemporary secular types of thinking.
It's importation.
Yes, importation.
It is importation. The most intellectual debates today in Islam are just like the so-called modern architecture of many Muslim countries. It is just taqlid of non-Muslim architecture, imitation, pale imitation of things developed in the West in every aspect of the Muslim life. So there is a lot to do to recover our authenticity. I wonder if, I hope it will take place.
Now what,
in intellectual discourse, I see new developments. You have people who are starting asking the real question. In the Sunni world, for example, one of them was Fazlur Rahman. Fazlur Rahman, who had a good training in classical Islamic tradition of thought, and was able to put the finger on a few problems. You have in the West people like Tariq Ramadan, who is indeed developing approaches and questionings that are helpful for many young people. I know far less the Shi'i tradition, but I'm sure that you also have in this very rich environment that you have in the theological schools of Iran, you have different thinkers that have indeed come with interesting questionings. I know of Ali Shariati, which I have read with great pleasure. You have people like Kadiva, Soruj, and others. So things are moving, but it will take time.
Mm-hmm.
The important thing, I think, is at the moment to make available the greatest number possible of classical texts, so that those who have focused on particular segments of the classical tradition can be contradicted by other segments of the classical tradition, which they ignore or refuse to take into account. The problem with the so-called traditionists or extremists is not that they are traditionists, that they follow the tradition. It is that they do not have enough tradition. They have a narrow knowledge of the tradition. If they knew about the wide spectrum, the very diverse possibilities offered by the classical tradition, they would not go for the extremes towards they go today. And reintroduction of falsafa, of the great debates of the past, will, I think, offer possibilities of development. I would suggest to everybody to read, for example, this Risala al-Hawiya fi Amr al-Ma'had by Ibn Sina. It is used by al-Ghazali, it is used by Fakhruddin al-Razi, it is used by the great later Islamic thinkers. And today, it is...
But when you mention philosophy, you talk about philosophy in Islam, and we also can talk about contemporary philosophy in the Western world.
Mm-hmm.
What is the difference? Both of them call themselves philosophy, and you find that, for example, Western-type philosophy also making intrusions into the Muslim world as under the guise of an impartial, objective evaluation and understanding of reality. What is the difference between the two?
I think that it's very typical of the West, and in some way it is specifically Christian, and it is due to the Christian history of the West that the West comes generation after generation with absolute claims. This is the final view on reality. This philosophy replaces a former philosophy. These new trends are what indeed gives us the most comprehensive understanding of the world around us, of ourselves, etc. And they change. Generation after generation, we see that, in fact, what was the truth then is now considered as obsolete, but there is a new claim. And so it's a nice intellectual exercise, which just lacks a little bit of humility and a little bit of relativism.
Mm-hmm.
Since Ibn Arabi, the great Spanish mystical master who dies in Damascus in 1240, we know in the Muslim world that rationality is itself a game played by imagination. So we are far more cautious towards those absolute claims of rationality.
So could philosophy exist without mysticism? Because, I mean, when you look at philosophy, when I think even Muslims think of the subject of philosophy, as I mentioned before, they think in terms of the fundamental role played by the intellect, by reason, right? And as you say, you know, it's a game of the imagination. Basically, if one, I think, relies completely on reason, only on reason, one can be led astray by reason in a certain sense.
Of course.
One has to...
Of course, that's why earlier on, I was speaking of the necessity of an agreement between sound reason and authentic scripture.
Right. Now, in understanding authentic scripture, we could understand authentic scripture also by using our reason, and also by transcending reason, not being irrational, but by transcending reason, for example, in terms of purifying the soul, you know, to understand or to grasp the essential point that these traditions want to bring. So again, where would, in your scheme of things, would mysticism or the mystic path
I don't know if we have to speak of mysticism as such. That's again imported terminology. I think that we have in Arabic and in the Islamic legacy enough terminology that can be used. I would say that exactly as you can't expect from Aql, which is irrigated with alcohol, any kind of sound rationality. There are different forms of souk, of hybridity, of drunkenness, which are not just physical. You can have ideological drunkenness. You can have emotional drunkenness. You can have spiritual drunkenness. And all those forms of drunkenness will have an impact on your akl, on your soul, on yourself, and I think will in some way lead astray your rationality. I don't believe in what some Muslim spiritual masters like Al-Ghazali or others were sometimes calling for emptying the heart so that inspiration could come into the heart. I have the impression, knowing what we are like as human beings and as poor sinners indigent for the mercy of their Lord, I am deeply convinced that if we empty our heart, the first one to come into it will be the devil.
Well, let me clarify in terms of what I mean by mysticism. In the sense that a purified heart, not really emptying the heart, but a person who is trying to live a pure life, a person who is struggling against his own, the own negative aspects of his soul, would be able to see the world from a different perspective.
Yes, that's what I'm calling for, that's what Islam is calling for, that's what Zikr Allah
exactly
means. And a heart which is dhakir, al-qalb dhakir, is much better, and I think we'll be able to grasp the truth and approach it in a much better way than just an empty heart.
Right.
And I think that without having to speak of mysticism, that's what Islam calls for. If Islam is reduced to some kind of formal obedience to religious in orders or commands, it doesn't make sense if it is not accompanied with the zawq, with the tasting, the enjoying of the savor of faith. It will not really be iman.
Exactly. Now, in terms of a process, you know, for example, you meet the Quran, you encounter with the Quran, you make an encounter with hadith, and our first point of view is to look at these words and understand them intellectually. And this is a process.
Yeah.
This is a method. You know, you very rarely hear about this other method. That in order to understand this, you have to purify the heart.
I prefer to hear the Quran than to read it. Because if you read it, you are the subject and the Quran is the object. If you hear it, it is going into you.
You're the recipient.
You're passive, and you're fed by it, and you're enriched by it. And I think that then you realize that it is not just a text that you can approach intellectually. You will not approach it without your intellect, but in fact, if you are enriched by it, it will have an impact on every dimension of your being. Again, I think that it's a text which is revealed through a messenger who is sent to us as a mercy for the world. There is more in this sending a messenger as a mercy than sending just a teacher. And I think that very often we do nothing else than concordism, which is importing into the Quran ideas that we grasp from outside of it, which means that in fact, instead of letting the Quran enlighten us, we are in some way turning off the light and covering the light which is sent to us to take us from darkness towards the light. And that's again there showing the fundamental importance of hermeneutics. What is the Quran for?
Dr. Michaud, we're running out of time, but my last question is, what can you advise the individual Muslim to do in order to revive the role of the intellect and the revivification of this intellectual tradition in Islam? What could the individual Muslim do in his own practice, in his own understanding to change that?
First thing, read Arabic, learn Arabic, and then go, I would say, at random into the classical tradition, the great text of the classical tradition, into the from the most diverse schools, to see the diversity that the great tradition represents, and develop a dialectic understanding of his own faith, being fed, being enriched as much by Ibn Arabi, as by Ibn Taymiyyah, by Al-Ghazali, as by Ibn Sina, without any kind of restriction. Mm-hmm. They were all Muslims. They all have something to say. They all come with sometimes just an atom, if you want to say, an atom of truth. But this atom of truth, it's worth having it in your brain at some point, so that indeed you can really enjoy yourself the great tradition of Islam. You will be better armed to face the challenges of modernity then.
Thank you very much.
You are welcome. It was a pleasure. Wallahu a'lam.
God alone knows. We had as our guest today Dr. Yahya Michaud, lecturer in the Faculty of Theology at Oxford University. And I want to thank you for joining us on this program. Remember, if you have any comments, questions, or criticisms, please don't forget to write us at mimbar@presstv.ir. That's mimbar@presstv.ir. And until next time, see you, same time, same channel on Mimbar.